Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In 1975, at the age of four, Viet Thanh Nguyen was brought to the United States by his parents from Vietnam as a refugee. This adjective, refugee, is one that is crucial to Nguyen, his writing, and the powerful talk you are about to hear. For nearly two decades, Nguyen wrote fiction without publishing a book, writing and revising short stories and then later a novel. Then, in 2015, Grove published his first novel called The Sympathizer. Very few people took notice. But the next year, it won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, the Edgar Award for First Novel, and a host of other of the nation's most coveted awards. Those propelled The Sympathizer to the New York Times bestseller list, where it stayed for months and transformed Nguyen's career. He has since published a book of stories called The Refugees and other works of nonfiction. Central to his literary project is one that seeks to clarify, understand, complicate, and otherwise redefine our understanding of who and what a refugee is, particularly as distinct from how one might define who an immigrant is. The ultimate goal of this project, I think, is one of creating empathy for refugees who have been misunderstood or treated as invisible and or had their human rights violated. Nguyen's work stands as a testament of how art can bring us closer to humanity through the power of storytelling. Here's Nguyen.
Thanks to all of you, Portland, for being here tonight. I think for the first time in my life, I sort of feel cool. I was born in Vietnam in 1971, and I came to the States as a refugee in 1975 when Vietnam fell or was liberated, depending on your point of view, and along with 130,000 other Vietnamese refugees, my family came to the United States, and we settled in one of the four refugee camps that were set up to handle these refugees, and ours was in Fort Indian Town Gap in Pennsylvania. And I remember this very clearly because this is when my memories begin. I don't remember anything about Vietnam, but I remember this refugee camp. And I remember very distinctly what happened next, which is that in order to leave this camp, we had to have sponsors, American sponsors. And the problem was that in the case of our family, there wasn't a sponsor that would take all of us. So one sponsor took my parents, one sponsor took my 10-year-old brother, and one sponsor took 4-year-old me. And now I'm the father of a 4-year-old child, and I can see this world better through my parents' eyes, and I can just imagine how painful it must have been for my parents to have their child taken away from them. And I remember, as a 4-year-old, crying and screaming being taken away from my parents. And this is where my memories begin. So I've spent decades trying to figure out what that experience means and how it connects me both to Vietnam and to the United States. And I have to say that being a refugee wasn't all bad. I was separated from my parents for just a few months. My brother, who was 10, was separated from them for 2 years. And he tells me, "That's how we know that mom and dad loved you more." Don't feel bad for him, he went to Harvard. Then just to rub it in, he went to Stanford too, which is what you're supposed to do when you're Asian. Anything less is like the Asian F, otherwise known as the B+. So being a refugee gave my brother the necessary motivation to become this great American success story. And I'm sort of thankful too, because being a refugee gave me the requisite emotional damage necessary to become a writer. And I've tried to pass that legacy on to my son. You know, he's 4 years old, and like most 4-year-olds, he loves Legos. And he's always asking for Legos. And you know, I just sort of have to tell him no. Sometimes you just can't have Legos. And then I ask him, "Do you know why you won't get these Legos?" And he said, "Because you're a refugee?" That's right. In my own weird writerly way, I'm trying to teach him about empathy. about who his grandparents are. Both sets of grandparents are Vietnamese refugees. His mom's a Vietnamese refugee. I'm a Vietnamese refugee. And he's going to learn that he's the descendant of Vietnamese refugees. I think it's important to teach our kids these kinds of things, teach them the values of empathy, to teach them about something called refugees, because there's so much lack of empathy concerning refugees today and so little awareness about who refugees are and how they're different from immigrants. So when I sat down to write The Sympathizer, it was very clearly in my mind going to be a war novel, but it was also going to be a novel about refugees. So I just wanted to share with you a little bit from the beginning of the book. And for those of you who haven't yet read the book, shame on you. This is what it's about. Communist spy, South Vietnamese Army, 1975. And his mission is to flee with the remnants of that army to the United States, where he's going to spy on their efforts to take their country back. And in order to do that, he has to become a refugee. So he ends up in the much more glamorous refugee camp of Camp Pendleton in Southern California. And here he's going to write a letter home to, or not home, but a letter to his aunt in Paris describing what life is like in a refugee camp. And since I think many people don't know what life is like in a refugee camp, I'm going to share this with you. If allowed to stay together, I told my aunt, we could have incorporated ourselves into a respectably sized, self-sufficient colony, a pimple on the buttocks of the American body politic, sufficiently collective to elect our own representative to the Congress and have a voice in our America, a little Saigon, as delightful, delirious, and dysfunctional as the original, which was exactly why we were not allowed to stay together, but were instead dispersed by bureaucratic fiat. Wherever we found ourselves, we found each other. We did our best to conjure up the culinary staples of our culture, but since we were dependent on Chinese markets, our food had an unacceptably Chinese tinge. Another blow in the gauntlet of our humiliation that left us with a sweet and sour taste of unreliable memories. Just correct enough to evoke the past, just wrong enough to remind us that the past was forever gone, missing, along with the proper variety, subtlety, and complexity of our universal solvent, fish sauce. Oh, fish sauce. How we missed it. How nothing tasted right without it. This pungent, liquid condiment of the darkest sepia hue was much denigrated by foreigners for its supposedly horrendous reek, lending new meaning to the phrase, there's something fishy around here. For we were the fishy ones. We used fish sauce the way Transylvanian villagers wore cloves of garlic to ward off vampires, in our case to establish a perimeter with those Westerners who could never understand that what was truly fishy was the nauseating stench of cheese. That's not a joke, it's really disgusting. What was fermented fish compared to curdled milk? But out of deference to our hosts, we kept our feelings to ourselves, sitting close to one another on prickly sofas and scratchy carpets, our knees touching under crowded kitchen tables, chewing on dried squid in the cut of remembrance until our jaws ached, trading stories heard second and third hand about our scattered countrymen. This was the way we learned of the Klan turned into slave labor by a farmer in Modesto, and the naive girl who flew to Spokane to marry her GI sweetheart and was sold to a brothel, and the widower with 9 children who went out into a Minnesotan winter and lay down in the snow on his back with mouth open until he was buried and frozen, and the regretful refugees on Guam who petitioned to go back to Vietnam, never to be heard from again, and the devout Buddhist who spanked his young son and was arrested for child abuse in Houston, and the husband who slapped his wife and was jailed for domestic violence in Raleigh, and the men who had escaped but left wives behind in the chaos, and the women who had escaped but left husbands behind, and the children who had escaped without parents and grandparents, and the families missing 1, 2, 3 or more children. Sifting through the dirt, we panned for gold, the story of the baby orphan adopted by a Kansas billionaire, or the mechanic who bought a lottery ticket in Arlington and became a multi-millionaire, or the girl elected president of her high school class in Baton Rouge, or the boy accepted by Harvard from Fond du Lac, or the movie star you love so much, dear aunt, who circled the world from airport to airport, no country letting her in after the fall of Saigon, none of her American movie star friends returning her desperate phone calls, until with her last dime, she snagged Tippi Hedren, who flew her to Hollywood. So it was that we soaked ourselves in sadness and we rinsed ourselves with hope, and for all that we believed, almost every rumor we heard, almost all of us refused to believe that our nation was dead. You know, when The Sympathizer came out, something happened that I knew was going to happen, which is that many reviewers called this an immigrant novel and called me an immigrant writer. And I was like, no, that's not true. I'm a refugee, and this is a refugee novel and a war novel. And I've said this over and over again. I had to, you know, write a New York Times op-ed to talk about this, and I spoke about it yesterday, and I'll speak about it today, and I'll speak about it tomorrow. And it bears repeating, simply because the idea of the immigrant is so strong in the American imagination that it overrides almost everything else. We're living in an age now of rising xenophobia directed against refugees and immigrants, which is actually not new in American history, and throughout most of American history, we've actually been pretty xenophobic about immigration, but we've developed this idea that we're a nation of immigrants. And even people today who don't like immigrants coming here like the idea that immigrants want to come here, because it proves that we're awesome. The land of the American dream. We don't want anybody else to dream it, but we understand that people want to come here for that. But refugees are different. And refugees are the unwanted where they come from, and they're unwanted where they come to. And I think they bring with them, obviously, a lot of stigma. And I asked the students today, well, when you think of refugees, or when you hear the word refugees, what do you think of? And they said, boats and refugee camps, starvation, wars, natural disasters, these kinds of things. And I think refugees come bearing with them these images that might be infectious. And maybe if you let these refugees in, they'll infect us with this possibility. And there's something also very particular about American culture that makes Americans allergic to refugees. I'll give you an example. Some of these Vietnamese refugees who came here in 1975 resettled in Louisiana. And then 30 years later, Hurricane Katrina happened. Well, if you remember, tens of thousands of people were displaced by Hurricane Katrina. And some of the American media called these people refugees. And President George Bush said, it's un-American to call these people refugees. And for perhaps the only time in history, Jesse Jackson agreed with him. A lot of these people were African Americans, and Jesse Jackson said, it's racist to call African Americans refugees. And I thought, great, we refugees have brought Americans together in hating us. But the idea of the refugees is simply anathema to the American dream. We as Americans cannot believe that this country could ever be the kind of country that produces refugees. The countries that produce refugees are failed states. You ask the people in Puerto Rico, they might agree that we're already there. But the rest of us would rather not think about that and would rather deny admission to more refugees. And we're not unique. Obviously, a lot of other countries feel that way too. Now, what's interesting for me is that it's not simply dyed-in-the-wool Americans, people who have been here many generations, who often reject the idea of accepting refugees. But even some refugees themselves don't want to accept more refugees. And I'm thinking specifically of my own Vietnamese brothers and sisters, the former refugees. Some of them are going around now saying, we're the good refugees. These other people, for example, these Syrians, these are the bad refugees. We shouldn't take in any more. I'll tell you something. I grew up in a Vietnamese refugee community of the 1970s and the 1980s, and I can tell you, there were a lot of bad Vietnamese refugees. Okay? I saw it with my own eyes. Welfare cheating, insurance scams, cash under the table economies. We invented the home invasion. That's the phenomenon of Vietnamese gangsters invading Vietnamese homes. It was so prevalent that the San Jose Police Department had to invent that term to talk about it. We were bad. There were bad refugees. But we've forgotten all about that. We prefer to remember people like my brother, the doctor, Right? I'm not bitter. We forget, and these Vietnamese refugees themselves forget, that in 1975, the majority of Americans did not want to take Vietnamese refugees, or Cambodian refugees, or Laotian refugees. But all that has been forgotten. Because now we see Vietnamese Americans, for example, as another example of the model minority success story. And we've forgotten that at one time, they were dangerous to American society. But I didn't forget, because I had an early reminder in the 70s about how other Americans might have perceived us. So my parents, we settled initially in 1975 in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and then 1978, my parents decided to move to San Jose, California. Thank God. And they opened perhaps the second Vietnamese grocery store in San Jose, in downtown San Jose. Oh yeah, somebody from San Jose, wonderful. Well, I remember walking, when I was about 10 or 11 years old, walking down the street in downtown San Jose from my parents' store and seeing a sign in another store window, and it said, "Another American driven out of business by the Vietnamese." And I was really too young to understand the full implications of this sign. It would take me decades to really figure this out. But I knew it was directed against my parents, me, people like us. And I thought, does this person who wrote this sign know that my parents work 12 to 14 hour days every day of the year in this grocery store? Does this person know that my parents were shot in the store on Christmas Eve? Does this person know what my parents have been through to become the people that they are and make it to this country? And of course, that person didn't know that. That person never was empathetic enough to try to imagine these circumstances. That person only saw my parents as Vietnamese, as refugees, as less than human, as others. And I absorbed that. So soon after that, I went to high school and in San Jose, and I went to a very elite high school that was primarily white. But there were a handful of us in that school who were of Asian descent, and we knew we were different. So every day at lunch, we would gather in a corner of the campus, and we would call ourselves the Asian Invasion. Well, you know, actually last year I went back to my high school campus 30 years later to give a speech, and as it turns out, we really have taken over. That's another story. So, Asian invasion. I mean, it's a racist term, right? But it clearly invokes that idea that Asians are a threat. And of course, if you think back to the sign, another American driven out of business by the Vietnamese, it's actually a sign that's been with us for a very long time in American history. It's really a sign that says, another American driven out of business by fill in the blank. You know, so in the 19th century, it was the Chinese, and then it was the Japanese, and then it was the Filipinos, and then the Koreans, and then it was the Vietnamese. So it's an old sign, but it brings with it that fear of invasion, of threat, of economic warfare, but also obviously of real warfare. And for me, that war was the Vietnam War, and I knew that war was really important to me by that time I was in high school, and I knew that it was really important to other Americans. And in my book, Nothing Ever Dies, I tried to be a little more analytical about the meaning of this war and all the other Asian wars that the United States has been involved with for me personally and for a lot of people like me. So this is a little bit from Nothing Ever Dies. As a gook in the eyes of some, I can testify that being remembered as the other is a dismembering experience, what we can call a disremembering. Disremembering is not simply the failure to remember. Disremembering is the unethical and paradoxical mode of forgetting at the same time as remembering, or from the perspective of the other who is disremembered, of being simultaneously seen and not seen. Disremembering allows someone to see right through the other, an experience rendered so memorably by Ralph Ellison in the opening lines of Invisible Man. His narrator, the titular hero, runs into a white man who refuses to see him, and enraged, strikes back to force the white man to see him. Even beaten, however, the white man refuses to see him the way he wishes to be seen. That is because the other's use of physical force may make the other visible, but only to turn him into a target. The other must deploy the psychic forces of remembering, imagining, and narrating if the other wishes to transform ways of seeing. Not satisfied with being disremembered, we who are others find that it is up to us to remember ourselves. Having carried ourselves over or been brought over from the other side, we gooks, we goo-goos, we slopes, we dinks, we zipperheads, we slant eyes, we yellow ones, we brown ones, we Japs, we chinks, we ragheads, we sand niggers, we orientals, we who cannot be distinguished between ourselves because we all look alike. We know that the condition of our being and our self-representation is that we are both ourselves and others. We are never without identity and never without ideology, whether we like it or not, whether we acknowledge it or not. Those people who believe themselves to be beyond identity and ideology will, sooner or later, charge us with identity and ideology if we dare to commit that most unnatural act of speaking up and out. So I've spent the last few years speaking up a lot about the Vietnam War, and again, trying to make sense of it, and trying to understand that, for me, the Vietnam War is obviously personally important because it shaped me, shaped my family, brought into existence the entire Vietnamese refugee community, but that it was important for something else as well, which is that it tells us a lot about how it is that this country, but also Vietnam, remembers and forgets. You know, when Americans say the word Vietnam, what they usually mean is the Vietnam War. And when they say the Vietnam War, what they really mean is the American War, which is how the war has affected Americans. So I'm sure a lot of you have been to Washington, D.C. and seen the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and Maya Lin's Black Wall and the 58,000 plus American names that are engraved there. And all those names add up to a huge tragedy. But what you don't see are any of the Vietnamese names, 3 million, or any of the Cambodian names or any of the Laotian names. And during the years of the war and afterwards, about 3 million Cambodians and Laotians died as well. So this act of memory on the part of Americans that's so important to them, to remember the 58,000 plus American dead and to remember this war that became a civil war in the American soul, takes place for a lot of Americans against the forgetting of these 6 million people whose names will never be commemorated on a wall like this because those countries don't have the ability to remember all of those names. So there's urgency on the part of writers like me to talk about this kind of history and to expand it as much as we can. Because I think for many people, when they hear the words the Vietnam War, they may think, okay, this is something that took place from 1965 or so to 1975 or so, and then it's over. It's a line in a history book, or even less. But for so many people that I knew, these Vietnamese refugees that I grew up with in San Jose during the 70s and 80s, it was very clear that the war was not over just because it had been declared to be over. I grew up among Vietnamese people who were constantly telling stories of loss, of bitterness, of rage, of melancholy, because they had lost everything. They had lost relatives, they had lost property, they lost identities, they had lost careers, they had lost their country. That's how they saw it. And they said all of this in Vietnamese. And sometimes they would say in Vietnamese, the Americans betrayed us. But when they spoke in English, they would say, "Thank you, America. It's quite great to be an American." That's because the place of Vietnamese refugees and other refugees in this society is to be grateful. We're expected to be grateful. And I can't tell you how many times I've gotten letters and emails from people, usually American veterans, saying, "We sacrificed for you. You should be grateful. Go back to Nam and take your son with you." That's too late. I'm already here. I think about this history, and I think about how do we understand this war. I think about the fact that when we say war in America, and probably war in many other countries, we think of men and soldiers and guns and battles and tanks. But this community of Vietnamese refugees that I knew, who were all traumatized by their history, by the war, some of them were men, some of them were soldiers, but a lot of them were not. Women, children, civilians. And when we think about this figure of 6 million dead people, many of them were civilians. And the Vietnam War and its effects in Cambodia and Laos was completely typical of the 20th century in killing more civilians than soldiers. So why is it that when we think of war, we think of men and soldiers and guns and battles and tanks? I think of war as something much bigger than that. War is something that involves all of us. War is something that kills civilians and produces refugees who then need to be rescued by the countries that bombed them. I think back to this passage and a story by my teacher, Maxine Hong Kingston, from her book, Chinamen. She has a chapter in there called "The Brother Who Went to Vietnam." It's about her brother who sat on a Navy ship, didn't shoot anybody. And she thought about how that experience of going to war, but not really going to war, like not actually firing a gun or anything like that, was actually much more typical for people during wartime than the act of shooting, right? So she has a passage about what it was like to be an American at home during these war years, and about how when you open the door of your refrigerator, she says, you're implicated in the war effort. The companies that make the plastic that wrap your Wonder Bread, the companies that make the coolant for the refrigerator, the companies that make the refrigerator, they're all part of the same military-industrial complex that produces Agent Orange and bombs. Now, that's a war story, but it's a war story that most of us don't want to think about. So in a strange way, thinking about war as hell and as war as something that involves soldiers, as terrifying as that may be, is actually a lot more comforting for us, because we can separate that and put that into a separate part of our imagination and not think about how we are all somehow implicated in that. So that's why the opening of Nothing Ever Dies is that line that Andrew already quoted. All wars are fought twice. The first time on the battlefield, the second time in memory. Because I've been around this country talking to many different people, it was already clear to me that for the Vietnamese refugees, they were constantly fighting the war over and over again. But I've met so many Americans, soldiers who went there, but also a lot of Americans who were here at home protesting against the war or just watching the war on TV. And for them, that war remains the defining moment of their generation. So the war is not finished for them as well. And when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, I had a very distinct reminder that this was true for Americans and for me. And that happened when my parents brought home this newfangled invention called the VCR, 1982 or so. And for those high school students who have no idea what I'm talking about, it's a box. It's a big box. And in it, you put another box. And you get to watch one movie at a time. So for me, that movie, the first movie, was Star Wars, Episode 4. I watched it a dozen times. And then I watched Apocalypse Now. Much too young of an age, early example of what happens when parents bring home cutting-edge technology and they leave their kids home alone with it. And you have to understand, by that point, I was an American. I loved American war movies, loved watching John Wayne, cheered for American soldiers. So then I put in Apocalypse Now, and I was cheering for the American soldiers up until the point they killed Vietnamese civilians. And then I was split in two. Was I the American doing the killing, or was I the Vietnamese being killed? And I didn't really realize how much of an impact this movie had on me until I recounted the movie to a college classroom about 10 years later, and I found myself shaking with rage and anger and disgust and realized that that story had traumatized me. I wasn't as traumatized as a refugee or as a soldier, but it had traumatized me. And it convinced me that stories were really, really powerful. That sign, "Another American driven out of business by the Vietnamese," 9 words, that's a story that's really powerful. Apocalypse Now, a story that's really powerful. And I set out and I watched just about every movie that Hollywood ever made about the Vietnam War, which is an exercise I recommend to nobody, so that I could understand how it is that, at least in the American imagination, they were fighting this war over again. And the reason why this was important is not simply because it mattered to Americans and therefore it mattered to me as a Vietnamese American, but that wherever I went in the world and I told people that I was working on the subject of the Vietnam War, inevitably someone would say to me, "Have you seen Apocalypse Now?" Everywhere. And so when it came time to write The Sympathizer, I thought, now's my chance to take revenge on Hollywood. So this is what I'm going to read to you next. It's a scene. What happens is, after my spy leaves the refugee camp, he has to get a job. And one of the jobs that he gets is to become the authenticity consultant on the making of a movie that looks suspiciously like Apocalypse Now. But if Francis Ford Coppola's lawyers were to ask, is not Apocalypse Now? And in fact, it's not. I mean, it's a compendium of all those movies that I saw. And in this version, these movies appear as an epic called The Hamlet, about American Green Berets who go to this Central Highlands village in Vietnam and are tasked with the mission of training the local ethnic minorities, whom they call Montagnards, to defend themselves against communism. And in this scene, my narrator has read the script, given the famous director his notes, and is here to talk to the famous director, who is known only as the auteur. My meeting with the auteur had gone on for a while longer, mostly in a more subdued fashion, with me pointing out that the lack of speaking parts for Vietnamese people in a movie set in Vietnam might be interpreted as cultural insensitivity. "Do you not think it would be a little more believable," I said, "a little more realistic, a little more authentic, for a movie set in a certain country, for the people in that country to have something to say, instead of having your screenplay direct, as it does now, cut to villagers speaking in their own language? Do you think it might not be decent to let them actually say something, instead of simply acknowledging that there is some kind of sound coming from their mouths? Could you not even just have them speak a heavily accented English? You know what I mean, Ching Chong English? Just to pretend that they are speaking in an Asian language that somehow American audiences can strangely understand?" The auteur grimaced and said, "Very interesting. Great stuff. Loved it. But I had a question." "What was it?" "Oh, yes. How many movies have you made?" "None." "Isn't that right?" "None. Zero. Zilch. Nada. Nothing. And however you say it in your language. So thank you for telling me how to do my job. Now get the hell out of my house and come back after you've made a movie or two. Maybe then I'll listen to one or two of your cheap ideas." It's a funny thing that after the book came out, I've met quite a few Hollywood people, and none of them dispute this characterization. I confess to being angry with the auteur, but was I wrong in being angry? This was especially the case when he acknowledged he did not even know that Montagnard was simply a French catch-all term for the dozens of Highland minorities. "What if," I said to him, "I wrote a screenplay about the American West and simply called all the natives Indians? You'd want to know whether the cavalry was fighting the Navajo or Apache or Comanche, right? Likewise, I would want to know, when you say these people are Montagnards, whether we speak of the Bru or the Nung or the Tay."
"Let me tell you a secret," the auteur said. "You ready? Here it is. No one gives a He was amused by my wordlessness. To see me without words is like seeing one of those Egyptian felines without hair, a rare and not necessarily desirable occasion. How could I be so dense? How could I be so deluded? I naively believed that I could divert the Hollywood organism from its goal, the simultaneous lobotomization and pickpocketing of the world's audiences. Hollywood did not just make horror movie monsters. It was its own horror movie monster, smashing me under its foot. I had failed, and the auteur would make the Hamlet as he intended, with my countrymen serving merely as raw material for an epic about white men saving good yellow people from bad yellow people. I pitied the French for their naivete in believing they had to visit a country in order to exploit it. Hollywood was much more efficient imagining the countries it wanted to exploit. I was maddened by my helplessness before the auteur's imagination and machinations. His arrogance marked something new in the world, for this was the first war where the losers would write history instead of the victors, courtesy of the most efficient propaganda machine ever created, with all due respect to Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis, who never achieved global domination. Hollywood's high priests understood innately the observation of Milton's Satan, that it was better to rule in hell than serve in heaven, better to be villain, loser, or anti-hero than virtuous extra, so long as one commanded the bright lights of center stage. In this forthcoming Hollywood tremblay, all the Vietnamese of any side would come out poorly, herded into the roles of the poor, the innocent, the evil, or the corrupt. Our fate was not to be merely mute. We were to be struck dumb. So when The Sympathizer came out, something else happened that I knew was going to happen. And that was that when the novel was reviewed for the first time, and it got a really great review on the front pages of the New York Times Book Review, which I didn't think was going to happen. But in that review, in the second or third line, the reviewer said, "Viet is the voice for the voiceless." And I was like, "No! Have you met any Vietnamese people? Been to a Vietnamese household? A Vietnamese restaurant? Vietnam itself? We're really, really loud." The problem is not that we're voiceless, it's that we're not heard. And so I've always resisted being called a voice for the voiceless, because I know it's actually not a compliment. It's meant as a compliment, but it's not. Because what people are really saying when they say that someone is a voice for the voiceless is that they would rather hear just one voice from the voiceless rather than to hear the whole chorus of voices from any given community. Or in the case of Vietnamese people, the cacophony of voices. And of course, as a writer, I do believe that we need individual voices, right? I, for example, growing up in San Jose in the 1970s and 1980s, did not realize what I was missing. I was watching Apocalypse Now and all these Hollywood movies about the Vietnam War, and I was watching 16 Candles and hearing Long Duk Dong talking in that Ching Chong English. I really needed Asian American and Vietnamese American voices, but I didn't find them. And looking back, of course, I think, well, it was partly due to structural racism. But of course, it was mostly due to Asian parents. That we didn't have enough writers out there. So Asian parents, do better. Don't crush the dreams of your children who want to be writers. Let them grow, let them flourish, so that one day they'll grow up and write scathing autobiographies featuring you. You know, I think we need more voices, but if we're committed to this idea of greater justice and greater equality in our society, what we really need is a society in which there aren't voiceless people. So that's why I think of myself always as not a voice for the voiceless, but as a writer who acknowledges that my existence, that my possibility, that my books were made possible by social and political movements that came before me. You know, that there was an Asian American movement that transformed American society and gave me the language in which to call myself an Asian American instead of a part of the Asian invasion. And that there were other Asian American authors that came before me who were once called the voices for the voiceless, and they've been forgotten. And I'm pretty sure that after me, there will be more voices for the voiceless. And that's a huge problem. We need to be a society in which everybody has access to having their voice heard. And that was my preoccupation when I was writing my short stories. I wrote a book called The Refugees, a collection of short stories. And it took me 17 years to write that book. And it'll only take you about 3 hours, I think, to read it. Which is, you know, that doesn't matter. You know, my misery is none of your business. But it was really 17 years. It's like, people ask me, you know, what does it take to be a writer? And my answer is, it takes the ability to suffer a lot, to endure a lot. And yeah, that was 17 years of mostly suffering to write those short stories. And it was suffering because I didn't know how to write. So I taught myself how to write through writing these short stories. But I was also preoccupied with this idea that there weren't enough Vietnamese stories out there, and that someone needed to come and go and write these stories. And what I didn't want to do in writing these stories was to talk about Vietnamese people and yet tell their stories through one perspective as if all Vietnamese people were the same. And of course we're not the same, right? You take a dozen Vietnamese people and they're all different from each other. But somehow they simply become the Vietnamese community and you have a voice for the voiceless to speak for all of them. So it was really important to me when I wrote these short stories that I talked about how different Vietnamese people were. That if I wrote a story about a man, the next story was going to be about a woman. And that if I wrote a story about someone straight, the next story was going to be about someone gay. And if it was about someone old, the next one would be about someone who was young. And then what was also really important to me in writing The Refugees was to acknowledge what I've already talked to you about, which is that when I was growing up among these Vietnamese refugees, what was very clear to me, besides the fact that the war wasn't over for them, was that they were haunted by the past. They were haunted by what had happened to them. They were haunted by everything that they had left behind and everyone that they had left behind. So The Refugees is also about haunting. I'm just gonna read a couple of pages from the very beginning of the book where that theme will be very evident. It's from Black Eyed Women. Fame, which strikes someone. Usually the kind that healthy-minded people would not wish upon themselves, such as being kidnapped and kept prisoner for years, humiliated in a sex scandal, or surviving something typically fatal. These survivors needed someone to help write their memoirs, and their agents might eventually come across me. "At least your name's not on anything," my mother once said. When I mentioned that I would not mind being thanked in the acknowledgments, she said, "Let me tell you a story." It would be the first time I heard this story, but not the last. "In our homeland," she went on, "there was a reporter who said the government tortured the people in prison. So the government does to him exactly what he said they did to others. They send him away, and no one ever sees him again. That's what happens to writers who put their names on things." By the time Victor Devoto chose me, I had resigned myself to being one of those writers whose names did not appear on book covers. His agent had given him a book that I had ghostwritten. Its ostensible author, the father of a boy who had shot and killed several people at his school. "I identify with a father's guilt," Victor said to me. He was the sole survivor of an airplane crash, 173 others having perished, including his wife and children. What was left of him appeared on all the talk shows, his body there, but not much else. The voice was a soft monotone, and the eyes, on the occasions they looked up, seemed to hold within them the silhouettes of mournful people. His publisher said that it was urgent that he finish his story while audiences still remembered the tragedy. And this was my preoccupation on the day my dead brother returned to me. My mother woke me while it was still dark outside and said, "Don't be afraid. Through my open door, the light from the hallway stung. Why would I be afraid? When she said my brother's name, I did not think of my brother. He had died long ago. I closed my eyes and said, I did not know anyone by that name. But she persisted. He's here to see us, she said, stripping off my covers and tugging at me until I rose, eyes half shut. She was 63, moderately forgetful. And when she led me to the living room and cried out, I was not surprised. He was right here, she said, kneeling by her floor armchair as she felt the carpet. It's wet. She crawled to the front door in her cotton pajamas, following the trail. When I touched the carpet, it was damp. For a moment, I twitched in belief, and the silence of the house at 4 in the morning felt ominous. Then I noticed the sound of rainwater in the gutters, and the fear that had gripped my neck relaxed its hold. My mother must have opened the door, gotten drenched, then come back inside. I knelt by her as she crouched next to the door, her hand on the knob, and said, "You're imagining things. I know what I saw." Brushing my hand off her shoulder, she stood up, anger illuminating her dark eyes. "He walked. He talked. He wanted to see you." "Then where is he, Matt? I don't see anyone." "Of course you don't," she sighed, as if I were the one unable to grasp the obvious. "He's a ghost, isn't he?" So I grew up with that sense of living in this haunted community. But it also struck me at a certain point that we weren't the only ones being haunted. Maybe we were the ones haunting this country as well. I think back to that Vietnam Veterans Memorial and all those unnamed Vietnamese people as an evidence of that kind of haunting. But in my own life, I had an experience of that too on a much smaller scale. And that was concerning what happened to my parents' grocery store. So they opened that grocery store in 1978. And despite what that sign said in that window, in downtown San Jose, there weren't a whole lot of people interested in opening new businesses, except for the Vietnamese refugees. So along with my parents, about 30 or 40 other Vietnamese shops populated downtown San Jose. And you have to know that at this time in the 70s and 80s, downtown San Jose doesn't look like what it does now, if you've ever visited. It's very glossy and polished now. But in the 1970s and 1980s, downtown San Jose was a rough place, even a violent place. I remember a couple of years ago, my classmate, my former high school classmate, who's now the mayor of San Jose, said to me, when he discovered that my parents had owned this grocery store, he said, "Did you know that the worst incident of anti-police violence happened in front of your parents' store? Like, two police officers were shot to death outside your parents' store, the worst incident ever in San Jose history." I was like, "No, I didn't know that. My parents never told me. I was away at college. They wanted to protect me." But this was downtown San Jose. And City Hall really didn't care about downtown San Jose until something called Silicon Valley happened. And then all these new tax revenues started to come into the city. And City Hall thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if we had a new City Hall that reflected the new San Jose? Guess where they built it? Not on my parents' store, but right across the street from my parents' store. And City Hall forced my parents to sell their property, and they forced most of those other refugee Vietnamese businesses to sell their property as well. And so my parents learned something new in their process of Americanization. They learned how to sue. And they should have, because City Hall was offering pennies on the dollar for their property. But it wasn't about the money. I mean, it was partially about the money, but it wasn't all about the money. It was about what that store symbolized for my parents and for me. That this was a store where they shed their sweat and their blood to sacrifice themselves for my brother and me and for all the other relatives in Vietnam to whom my parents were sending money throughout the 70s and the 80s because Vietnam was starving. And this was a place where my parents had sacrificed themselves for me so much that they couldn't spend any time with me. And so this store represented everything for me in terms of just how physically and spiritually damaging the experience of being a refugee shopkeeper had been for my parents. And now it was going to be erased. It was very painful for me. And so for years and years and years after that, whenever I would go to downtown San Jose, I would never go to this stretch of East Santa Clara Street between 3rd and 4th because I did not want to see how my parents' store had been erased. And then something called the Pulitzer Prize happened. And City Hall thought, wow, wouldn't it be great to invite Viet back to San Jose and give him a commendation in City Hall? Always be careful about inviting writers to come speak. So I said, of course, yes, I'll take the commendation. And I went back to City Hall and I told them the exact same story that I'm telling you. But before that, I parked my car in the garage beneath City Hall, and then I went upstairs to East Santa Clara Street, and I hadn't been there for years and years. And so I finally looked across the street to where my parents' store had been. And for all these years, I had thought that City Hall had built a parking garage on my parents' property. But there was no parking garage. There was only a parking lot. And it was only half full. And it reminded me of a line from The Sympathizer about how America's greatest architectural contribution to the world is the parking lot. And I realized that City Hall would rather look out onto a half-empty parking lot than to look out on a mom-and-pop Vietnamese refugee grocery store. And if you visit San Jose, downtown San Jose today, you will see no sign that for a couple of decades there had been a thriving Vietnamese community here. There are no signs. There are no memorials. There are no plaques. There are nothing but the memories of the people who had worked there and their children, people like me. And if I didn't write stories, all of that would be forgotten. And in fact, I wrote one short story, one autobiographical short story, and it was about my parents' grocery store. It's called War Years in the Refugees. And when the Refugees was translated into Vietnamese earlier this year, the government censored one short story from the book, War Years. So we had been erased in the United States, and we've been erased in Vietnam. And if we didn't have writers and storytellers, all those memories would be forgotten. That's why I write. Thank you so much.
That was Viet Thanh Nguyen from Port Lexan Lectures in 2018. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.